Sisters and brothers in the Dharma, Namo Buddhaya, Jai Bhim.
Jai Bhim.
Well, a very warm welcome to the Padmaloka Shrine Room, those of you who are not already in the Padmaloka Shrine Room. This is the last talk in our series on the Bodhicharya Avatara, and I thought it would be good if you had another look at the assembled Padmaloka community gathered here for this talk on our weekly day retreat. So once again, Satyakirti is panning round so that you can have a look at us misfits who live here. And I hope Satyakirti won't forget himself either. So yes, as I've said, this is the last talk in our exploration of the Bodhicharya Avatara of Shantideva, the great 8th century text describing the Bodhisattva's life, the Bodhisattva's practice. And it's been quite a journey giving a talk every week on the Bodhicharya Avatara. And I was reflecting earlier, well, why did we decide to do this series? For me, it just came into my mind, I needed to do a series of talks on the Bodhicharya Avatara as a response to the situation that the world is in. When we had the news of COVID-19 spreading throughout the world, when we had the very shocking news that we would have to go into lockdown as everybody else is going into lockdown, the immediate thought I had was we need to study the Bodhicharya Avatara. We need to really look at the Bodhisattva path. We need to be inspired by the Bodhisattva path more than ever, more than ever. And I wanted to offer this series to Bhante Urgyen Sangharakshita, my teacher, who I feel nothing but gratitude towards because he introduced me to the Dharma so directly, so vividly, in a sense, so powerfully. In so many different ways, including his presentation of the Bodhisattva ideal, the Bodhisattva path, including his own exploration of Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatara. So this series of talks has been on a journey, and of course Padmaloka itself has been on a journey since we went into this period of lockdown. It was a big shock for us. It was a big shock for us, as it has been for everybody throughout the world. In so many ways, it's been shocking for us. There's the state of the world, the suffering in the world, the uncertainty in the world, the fear and anxiety in the world. That affects us, like, you know, we're part of this world. It affects us very, very powerfully, very, very deeply. It challenges us to take our practice, our Dharma practice, in relation to that situation. And then there's the immediate effect. You know, there's we're not able to visit our families like so many of the rest of you in the world. We're not able to visit mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and other relations, even children. There are men here who are fathers. We're not able to see our friends, and especially our friends, many of us for ordination, order members and other friends, are not able to come to Padmaloka. Padmaloka exists as a retreat centre. You know, for however many years it is, I can't remember how it was, since 1976, Padmaloka has just opened its doors regularly for people to come and spend time here for weeks on end, maybe even longer sometimes, or even just a short weekend, just to practice with us, just to practice the Dharma, learn the Dharma with us, to live in spiritual fellowship and spiritual friendship with us. It's a huge loss for us. It's a huge loss for us that people can't come and be here. In a sense, our raison d'etre has been taken away from us. Now, of course, compared with the suffering of so many people, a real suffering that people are undergoing, this doesn't sound like very much suffering, does it? You might think it's a minor thing, but for us, it does cut us. It does make us sad. It does make us a bit melancholy because we can't do what we do to contribute to the world. We felt in the early days of this lockdown that we wanted to kind of go inwards. It was quite interesting. We did do outward things, including this series of talks and other things, contacting people and so on and so forth. But in the early stages of this lockdown period, we didn't feel it was quite appropriate yet to do more extensive things online, using Zoom for sort of retreats or seminars and so on. We felt that we needed to really go more deeply into our practice. In a sense, we wanted to practice in a more viveka, more withdrawal. That might sound a bit strange, a bit counterintuitive. I can't, in a way, tell you why we did that, but that was our feeling. That was our feeling, that there was a sort of almost a feeling of renunciation, of deeper renunciation that arose in us. As I say, not completely, because we were giving out, and there have been many very positive responses to what we've been doing here. So many letters of encouragement have come to us for what we're doing in this period. But as time has gone on, we feel the time is now come for a change. We want to be, as it were, more outward going, as the technology allows. We've also been upgrading our technology as well during this period. So we are going to be now, the conclusion of this series of talks, we're now going to be moving much more into a phase of offering sort of retreats, in inverted commas, or seminars, I don't know what the language is, using Zoom. We've already started that, particularly for many of us for ordination. We're going to do a few other things as well, but mainly we want to respond to men who've asked for ordination so that they can carry on and deepen their training for ordination. So in a way, what we've perhaps gone through at Padmaloka is a little bit of what gives rise, is said to give rise to the bodhicitta, withdrawal and engagement. Withdrawal and engagement. In a sense, there's been a sort of forced withdrawal, which we've sort of entered into. But we have been engaging, and we're going to engage even more as the technology and the limitations of existence allows. I should just say that this experience of a withdrawal the way we didn't immediately embrace the technology of communicating the Dharma online is also partly to do with our experience. We love being in the presence of people. That's what we exist to do. We want to be with people directly. That's what we love. That's what spiritual community really is. And I think that was one of the great shocks for us, because of this lifeblood of being together with others in the same space. So it's taken us a while to realize, yes, we can be with others in another way, via Zoom, and have the online seminars and retreats and so on. And we're embracing that joyfully, happily. We're inspired. All of us are inspired to do that. So now we're going to move into a new phase, which we're calling 108 days of Dharma. 108 days of Dharma. You'll be hearing more about this, so watch your inboxes. We're emerging from a sort of seclusion and we're moving into this new phase with, if you like, the prayer, the hope, that the aspiration that soon, please soon, we can open our doors again and people can come here. That's what we long for. We long for the day when our gates and our doors will be open and people can come here and enjoy and celebrate this wonderful place that we live in called Padmaloka. We so badly want to share that in real life. Yes, we can do it to some extent through technology, but we badly want to share it again in real life. So this is the last talk in this series, and in many ways it's the most difficult talk of all. Today we're concerned with chapters 9 and 10, the chapters devoted to the perfection of wisdom and dedication, the last two chapters of the Bodhicharyavatara. Here Shantideva teaches the last of the paramitas, the perfection of wisdom, and then in the dedication section, the Parinamana section, he makes great, vast, and specific dedications expressing the full maturing of the Bodhisattva's life, its consummation, if you like. Very, very beautiful verses that we find in that last chapter. And yes, I hope you'll notice that when we get to that last chapter. But before that, we've got to do some hard work by looking a little into Shantideva's treatment of the perfection of wisdom. And I will say at once, as in many places with the Bodhicharyavatara, but particularly here, I feel out of my depth, and my exploration of the perfection of wisdom chapter will be inevitably patchy and superficial. I want to make that very, very clear. So let's hear how Shantideva opens the Prajnaparamita chapter of the Bodhicharyavatara. It is for the sake of wisdom that the Muni, that's the Buddha, it is for the sake of wisdom that the Muni taught this entire collection of preparations. Therefore, in the desire to put an end to suffering, one should develop wisdom. It is for the sake of wisdom that the Muni taught this entire collection of preparations. Therefore, in the desire to put an end to suffering, one should develop wisdom. So Shantideva makes it very clear here that the Bodhisattva path, generating the bodhicitta, taking the bodhisattva vows, practicing the paramitas, they're all performed, lovingly performed, for the sake of prajna, for the sake of prajna paramita, the perfection of wisdom. Through the collection of virtues, which the previous chapters have described, we change and transform so that we can see things as they really are, directly. If we want to see things as they really are, directly, unmediated by any words, any concepts, any ideas, we need the preparation to do that. We need the preparation of the other paramitas to do that. Through that we transform. We transform through those paramitas. It's wisdom that makes that transformation irreversible. So we need to develop wisdom to really put an end to suffering for self and others. This is what he says. Remember, very early on, right back at the beginning of this series of talks, we have that wonderful words, ordinary goodness, having given its fruit, like the banana tree, begins to decay. But that tree, which is the bodhicitta, begets, it fruits, but does not decay. It bears fruit perpetually. He's talking about the bodhicitta here in the fullest sense. The full fruiting, the perpetual fruiting of the bodhicitta can only happen if our goodness, our generosity, our ethics, our patience, our energy, our deep meditation is united with wisdom, is united with prajna. So we need to develop and cultivate wisdom. Throughout the Bodhicharya Avatara, Shantideva has made this very clear. You remember, in most of the chapters, he seasoned his exposition of each of the paramitas with reflections on prajnaparamita, on the perfection of wisdom. That's the way those paramitas have become paramitas. They become paramitas when they're the expression of wisdom. But it's so important that we understand that we need to prepare for wisdom. You can't go straight to wisdom. Some people are impatient. They want wisdom, they want insight immediately, but they don't want to do the work. They can think that wisdom is a kind of technique or a trick. Insight is a trick or a technique that will somehow yield wisdom. But we need to work. We need to really work on ourselves, really change through the practice of the collections, the paramitas. You get another extreme. Sometimes people can be complacent and content with a good, harmless Buddhist life. But there's no real wisdom. There's no real seeing. Therefore, there's no real lasting transformation. We need, in other words, both aspects. We need what's known in Mahayana Buddhism generally as the accumulation of punya, merit, goodness, and the accumulation of jnana, the accumulation of wisdom. Both of those need to be present. Both need to be there. The auras on the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas represent these two accumulations. The body aura, which is much bigger, represents the accumulation of punya, which comes about through the practice of the first five paramitas. The aura around the head symbolizes the accumulation of jnana, the accumulation of wisdom. Both need to be there. Let's see where Shantideva goes next in his exposition of wisdom. It is agreed, this is just verse 2, it is agreed that there are two truths, the conventional and the ultimate. Reality is beyond the reach of the intellect. Intellect is said to be conventional. So Shantideva quickly plunges us into the teaching of the two truths, the Sangvritti Satya, the conventional truth, and the Paramata Satya, the ultimate truth. Shantideva, of course, is in the tradition of the great Nagarjuna, who's regarded as the founder of the Madhyamaka school, the school of the middle way. And in this school, the two truths are of very, very great importance. Indeed, the two truths are important throughout the Mahayana. And it's very, very easy, I think, to misunderstand the teaching of the two truths, especially if one is not seriously practicing the Dharma, especially if one is not going for refuge. Sometimes when people hear the words conventional and ultimate, they think, I want the ultimate. The conventional, that sounds so boring. Who wants to be conventional? I'm interested in the ultimate. I'm capable of the ultimate. I'm beyond the conventional. And they will emphasize, you know, they'll look at teachings that purport to communicate the ultimate position. They're even disdainful of the conventional. But Shantideva cuts through that in this line. this half line from this from the verse. Reality is beyond the reach of the intellect. Reality is beyond the reach of the intellect. The intellect is said to be conventional. So reality is beyond the reach of the intellect. Buddhar agocharas tattvang buddhi samvritre ucchayate. Reality is beyond the reach of the intellect. The word for beyond the reach is agochara. Agochara. Let me say a bit about this word, gochara. I've discovered recently the word gochara crops up a lot in Buddhist tradition, going right back to the Pali Canon. A go is a cow. Chara means walking around. So a gochara is where a cow goes. In other words, it's a pasture, but it comes to mean a range. Even it can be translated as a sphere. In other words, it describes where you live and what you feed on. Where you live, where you go, and what nourishes you, what sustains you. Reality, truth, nirvana, shunyata. They are all beyond the intellect, beyond thoughts, ideas, concepts of any kind. Even words like emptiness, non-dual awareness, all that stuff, form and emptiness, they are all just words. That's all intellect. It's all ideas. If you're still dependent on them, nourished by them, no matter how refined the concept, you are not at the ultimate level. You are not at the Paramata Satya. You're still in the conventional. This is very, very important to understand. Sometimes I think people think, emptiness, non-duality, that's the ultimate position. No, they're just words. They're just words. The ultimate is beyond. There are no words. There's not even silence. Even silence is refuted at the ultimate level. So be very, very clear about that. It takes us back, this discussion, to the dawning of the Sasana, the dawning of the Buddha's dispensation, of the Buddha Dharma. There's that description that the Buddha gives of his enlightenment, where he's reflecting on the profundity of reality, of the Dharma that he's realized, of this truth, Pratityasamutpada, of Nirvana. He reflects, it's subtle, profound, ataka vacharo, beyond the reach, beyond the sphere of thought, of reasoning, beyond all words and language. The Buddha himself in the Dhammapada describes the Buddha, the enlightened one, as ananta gochara. His sphere, his pasture is endless. He's nourished by no boundary and no dimension. So let's be very, very clear about this. It's so easy to look down on the conventional, on the classical Buddhist formulations, Pratityasamutpada, the Four Noble Truths, the path of practice, morality, meditation, and wisdom. But it's so important to remember that the Buddha and the great teachers, including Shantideva, as we will see, taught these conventional truths, if you like, these common sense truths. Perhaps that would be a better translation. The common sense truths, the practical truths, in order for us to discover the agochara, the ananta gochara, that which lies beyond. As Bhante said in a seminar when we were grilling him on conventional and ultimate truth, he said, well, the trouble is people forget that the ultimate truth is the ultimate truth of the conventional truth. Meaning, I think, that the conventional truths as taught by the Buddha and the great teachers are not arbitrary. They haven't been, you know, it's not that you could have another kind of conventional truth that describes the Dharma. You go deeply, deeply, deeply into the conventional truth to emerge, as it were, into the ultimate truth. So let's go a bit further into what Shantideva has to say about this. In the light of this, this teaching of conventional and ultimate, in the light of this, people are seen to be of two types, namely the spiritually developed and the spiritually undeveloped. Of these, the worldview of the undeveloped is invalidated by the worldview of the spiritually developed. This is very important. You can see at once he's making it concrete. Conventional and ultimate truth seems very abstract, but he's saying, no, it's actual people who see these truths. Spiritual development, the spiritually developed, is Crosby and Skilton's translation of yogi, indicating that the ultimate truth is seen by through direct realization. It's the yogi that really sees what is beyond. Spiritually undeveloped is a translation of prakritika, meaning common, vulgar. So be clear who you are. Are you a yogi or are you common and vulgar? Be clear where you are. Don't assume that you can have the world view, the drishti of the yogi, when you're actually one of the common folk, one of the spiritually undeveloped. And the yogi's vision, the spiritually developed vision, the bodhisattva's vision, invalidates that of the undeveloped. But here we need to take great care as well. It's very hard to know who the real yogi, who the really spiritually developed, really are. The Buddha makes that very clear, that you have to really get to know somebody for a very, very long time and really know their views and their behaviours and how they're responding in all sorts of different situations to really conclude whether or not they're genuinely spiritually developed. He continues with this theme, he's almost describing a sort of spiritual hierarchy. Even the views of the spiritually developed are invalidated by the superior understanding of those at successively higher levels by means of an analogy which is accepted by both parties. This will come a bit later. Then Shantideva tells us what the difference is, and this is where his analogy comes, between what an ordinary person sees, what the common people see, and what the spiritually developed, what the yogi sees. So let me read this verse, two verses. Ordinary people see existent things and also imagine them to be real. That is to say, not as an illusion. It is in this regard that there is disagreement between the ordinary person and the spiritually developed. So the yogi sees everything as illusion. The spiritually underdeveloped sees everything, sees things and imagines that they are real. Even the objects of direct perception, such as visible form, are only established by popular consensus and not by a valid means of knowledge. That consensus is wrong. Like, for example, the popular view that impure things are pure. So here is the vast difference between the vision of the yogi, the bodhisattva, and ourselves. We see existent things and we imagine them to be real. It reminds me of going right back to early Buddhism in the first chapter of the Dhammapada in the pairs. Those who take the unreal for the real and who in the real see the unreal, they, wandering in the sphere, Gochara again, of wrong thought, will not attain the real. Those who have known the real as the real and the unreal as the unreal, they, moving in the sphere of right thought, will attain the real. And thought isn't quite right. It's sankappa, which is sankalpa. So it's more like intention, the sphere of perfect intention that's being talked about here. We imagine that there are real, permanently existing people and objects which we can possess and own. People, objects, worlds that are pure, that are beautiful, that are ultimately satisfying, which will give us eternal happiness, which are in reality illusion, illusory, as we ourselves are. Oh yes, this language of Maya, of illusion, illusory, there is appearance. Here we are, I'm here, you're there, nobody is disputing that. But if we were to analyse, and Shantideva does some analysis later on, if we were to analyse, we would discover there is no permanent, real, separately existing element whatsoever. Everything vanishes, any sense of a sort of permanently existent self and other just vanishes like a dream, like a magician's illusion. And our grasping for and clinging onto this phantom existence, this phantom self and other, that is the cause of our suffering. That is the great tragedy of life. And we'll be hearing a bit more about that later. But the wise, the Buddhas, know very well that although the nature of things is illusion and illusory, they know very well that they have to relate to our belief, our imagining of a really existent world. They have to operate within that sphere out of compassion. They see everything as illusion, but they have to relate to us, people who see things in terms of permanent entities. So the next verses, the verses go on. The protector taught in terms of existent things in order to guide people. If it is objected that on the basis of conventional usage, that in reality these entities are not momentary, the fact is that there is no fault in the use of conventional truth by the spiritually developed. They understand reality better than ordinary people do. Otherwise, ordinary people would invalidate the insight into the impurity of the body. Merit comes from a conqueror who is like an illusion in the same way as it would if he was truly existent. A bit later on in the text, trying to illustrate this, he says, as the wishing gem and the magical tree fulfill desires, so the appearance of the conqueror is seen because of his vow and the people who need to be trained. Just as a pillar empowered by an expert in poisons, who then dies, will continue to neutralize venom and other poisons even when he is long dead, so too the pillar, that is the conqueror, empowered by following the path to enlightenment, continues to achieve all ends even after that bodhisattva has attained enlightenment. So the basic points here are that the Buddha will teach us using the language of conventional truth, of really existent things. He will teach, for example, morality. Let's just take the first precept. There is a real person there, a real being there. So treat them well, with kindness and consideration, because if you speak harshly to them, they will get hurt. That's real. Pay attention to that. The reality is, let's just take meditation. The reality is you are distracted. You are a really distracted person. So don't pretend that you don't have a self when you're a really distracted person. And concentrate on your real breath. Otherwise, you won't heal the ailment of distraction. Take wisdom. Your actions, your real actions of body, speech and mind have real consequences for self and other. So act skillfully. Act with a pure mind. Don't pretend that you're experiencing shunyata when you don't. So this is crucially important. Merit comes from a conqueror, whether you regard him as an illusion or not. So it's very, very important that we don't delude ourselves here. The Buddhas don't pretend that we've experienced not self when we haven't. They will teach us what we really need to do in order to cure us of our belief in a real self. So this brings us to a famous quote, which is often attributed to Nagarjuna, but actually it's from the Maharatnakuta Sutra, where the Buddha says, Kashyapa, the view of personality, the view of Atman, of a real Pudgala, even if it is as big as Mount Meru, is relatively easy to abandon, but not so for a decidedly arrogant view of emptiness. If you have a conceited view of emptiness or of not-self, you have turned the medicine of shunyata and not-self into poison. You've turned the Dharma into poison, and therefore it's very, very difficult for you to be cured. If you have a strong belief in a self, you can actually do something. You've got something to actually work with, especially you have the basis for empathy. But if you have this conceited view that you don't really exist, and nor does anybody else, you're in real trouble. So with that in mind, always, we can look further into Shantideva's chapter on wisdom, which is all about, mainly about establishing the vision of emptiness, of shunyata. As I said at the beginning, I do feel out of my depth here. Shantideva's approach to emptiness is to establish the right understanding of emptiness. And I think this is why Crosby and Skilton have translated the Perfection of Wisdom chapter, the Perfection of Understanding. The verses that Shantideva gives need a lot of commentary because he's refuting in these verses all kinds of intellectual objections. Crosby and Skilton's translation is really helpful here. I must just say, I must give praise to Kate Crosby and Andrew Skilton for their wonderful translation of the Bodhicaryavatara. It really is an extraordinary contribution to the Dharma in the West. It's a wonderful translation, very clear, very fluent, and with really good notes and really good commentary. And I'm very grateful to them, as I am indeed to all the different translations of the Bodhicaryavatara that are available to us, and the Sanskrit text, which is online in different places, and the various commentaries that have been done. We really are grateful to these great translators, and we bow our heads in gratitude and reverence towards them, because they've made this wonderful deck so vivid for us. We ought to have a great long list, really, at the end of all the different things and people that I've consulted. But anyway, what Shantideva does in this wisdom chapter is deals with so many objections to his radical Madhyamaka view, middle way view of emptiness. He deals with objections coming from Hinayana schools. He deals with objections coming from the Chittamatra, the mind-only schools. He deals with objections coming from various kinds of what we would call Hindu schools, Sankhya, and so on. Passing through these, he refutes the notion of a belief in a creator God. He also defends the validity of the Mahayana Sutras. All this actually is of very great importance, but I have to admit, far too intelligent and subtle for somebody like myself. I just don't have, unfortunately, the mind for it. But I hope one day someone will present a commentary on this material, because I feel certain that the views that Shantideva are refuting are not just views that were being brought up in the 8th century by these different positions. They're views that we would all hold in one way or another, which we could seek out. We hold them probably unconsciously. And it would be great if somebody with a really good mind, a really good, subtle, sharp, incisive intellect could do something with this material to show how we could use Shantideva's method to refute our own wrong views. Some might think that this is an intellectual game, but I don't think it is. It's so crucially important that we develop right view, a clear intellectual understanding of the Buddha's vision. That clarity, allied with positive emotion, those two are indispensable for development along the path. Bhante said in 1984 on our Tuscany retreat that I was supporting, he said he thought that what really should characterize a Buddhist is intellectual clarity and positive emotion. And you can see there the germs of wisdom and loving kindness, the germs of wisdom and compassion. Having said that, I did wonder sometimes, reading this last chapter, and in fact throughout the Bodhicaryavatara, that there's a kind of tension sometimes between Shantideva, the visionary bodhisattva, the yogi, Shantideva, the devotee, and Shantideva, the debating pandit. I just wondered sometimes. There are verses with very direct evocations of the practice of emptiness, and then quickly he has to go into an argument to refute somebody. But having said that, I suspect that I'm just expressing my own limitation. Between verses 9 and 34, Shantideva tirelessly refutes any notion of real existence or any notion of non-existence. Emptiness transcends existence and non-existence. Assertion is negated. Negation is negated. Both and neither are negated. He really reveals the middle way, the Shunya Vada, the Madhyama Vada. All conceptions dissolve into emptiness. Even silence dissolves into emptiness. Verse 34 is sort of crucial. So in this verse, Shantideva says, when neither being nor non-being stand before the mind, then, with nothing more for the mind to do, one rests in perfect peace. When neither being nor non-being stand before the mind, then, with nothing more for the mind to do, one rests in perfect peace. It said when Shantideva uttered this verse at Nalanda, he rose into the sky and vanished into space. Apparently, his voice kept sounding from the sky, from space, teaching the truth of emptiness out of compassion for his listeners, as well as describing what a bodhisattva is. I'm going to read some of these verses. Remaining in cyclic existence for the benefit of those suffering through delusion is achieved through freedom from the two extremes, attachment and fear. This is the fruit of emptiness. So that being the case, there is no valid objection to the emptiness position. Therefore, emptiness should be meditated upon without reservation. Since emptiness is the countermeasure to the darkness of obscuration of what is known and the obscuration of the defilements, how is it that that one who desires omniscience does not make haste to meditate upon it? Granted, that something which causes suffering causes fear. But emptiness allays suffering. So why does it cause fear? Granted, too, fear may come from any quarter whatsoever if there is something called I. If your position is that there is no I, who can be afraid? So this is describing what a bodhisattva really is. He remains in the world, free of attachment and fear, because he's realized emptiness. He remains in the world, free of attachment and fear, to benefit others. It's very, very hard to understand what a bodhisattva really is. He or she is a very different kind of being, though they might seem like us. They might look just like anybody else, but they are in the world on an entirely different basis. Back in the mid-1970s, when I first encountered the Dharma, and there was Marian Matic's translation of the Bodhicharyavatara, which I really loved, and his introduction to the different chapters, and which Bhante did a seminar on, and I loved reading that seminar. There were certain things that really struck me and just lodged in my mind until this very day. And here's one of those things that lodged in my mind. So Marian Matic says, when he's trying to describe a bodhisattva, the bodhisattva hovers benignly between being and non-being upon a plateau of pure thought. Here's Bhante's commentary on that. That's very good, hovering benignly between being and non-being. But upon a plateau of pure thought, that could be misunderstood. Pure thought sounds quite abstract and conceptual, whereas it isn't at all like that. It's a plateau of higher spiritual realization, one could say. Matic again. And from that vantage point, the bodhisattva reaches deep into the maya and muck of phenomenality. Bhante, maya and muck of phenomenality. The bodhisattva doesn't really see it like that. Because since he's above these extremes of being and non-being, samsara and nirvana, for him, everything is transfigured. And at the higher stages of his experience, his whole life and activities and bodhisattva deeds become a sort of play, a sort of spontaneous manifestation. It's the other people who see the mire and the muck, not the bodhisattva. He doesn't see the mire and muck as mire and muck. So to speak, this shows that it's quite difficult to get into the bodhisattva's mind, his inner experience, his heart, as it were, that this text, the Bodhicharyavatara, is all about. But one cannot have much more than a glimpse of it. So I really love that particular passage. It really thrilled me when I was discovering the Dharma. So Shantideva goes on. He gives a kind of meditation, a kind of six-element meditation. He's after talking about emptiness in those verses I just read before, he goes into this. Just goes straight into this meditation. The teeth, hair, or nails are not I. Nor is the bone, nor am I the blood. Neither the mucus, nor the phlegm, not the pus, nor the synovial fluid. I am neither the marrow nor the sweat. I am neither the lymph nor the intestines. I am not the rectum, nor am I the excrement or the urine. I am neither the flesh nor the sinews. I am neither heat nor wind. I am neither the orifices nor in any way the six consciousnesses. So it's rather like a kind of essentialized form of our meditation, our contemplation of the six elements that we do in our own order and movement. Later on, he also goes into the nature of the mind. The past or future mind is not I. since that does not exist. If the present mind is I, then when has it ceased? The I does not exist anymore. Just as the trunk of a banana tree is nothing when split into pieces, in the same way too, the I is not a real entity when hunted out analytically. This word analytically, vichara, in other words, reflected upon in deep meditation. We hunt out, we look for this notion of I, we will not find it. And Shantideva concludes with this chapter 10, with very moving and very poignant verses. I think in many ways they speak for themselves. There is no cessation, and there is no coming into existence at any time. Therefore, none of this entire universe has come into existence or ceased. Rather, the states of existence are like dreams, on an analysis the same as the trunk of a banana tree. There is in substance no difference between those who have attained liberation and those who have not. When all things are empty in this way, what can be received, what taken away, who can be honoured or humiliated by whom? From what can there be happiness or misery, what can be liked and what loathed? What craving can there be? For what is that craving when examined as to its true nature? On analysis, what world of living beings is there? Who then will die in it? Who will come to exist? Who has existed? Who is a relative? Whose is whose friend? May all of my kind accept that everything is like space. Because of quarrels and merriment, they become now angry, now happy, with feelings of grief, vexation and despair, harming one another because of their evil actions. They lead their lives miserably, longing for their own happiness. As people live like this, pretending they will not grow old or die, horrific misfortunes approach, with death the foremost of them. When shall I provide relief for those tormented in the fire of such suffering, with offerings of happiness flowing from the clouds of my merit? When may I respectfully teach emptiness and the accumulation of merit by means of the conventional truth, without reliance on imagining a real world, to those who imagine a real world? It's very, very beautiful. We live our lives suffering so much, causing so much suffering, because we ignore, because we don't see the profound view, the profound vision of emptiness. Tibetan tradition says that Shantideva is in the Bodhisattva lineage of the profound view, the Madhyamaka lineage. There's another Bodhisattva lineage which is associated with the Sangha and the Yogacara tradition, called the lineage of extensive deeds. It's good to have both of these together. This word profound is the translation of the Sanskrit gambhira, which means deep. It's very, very important to remember this. The language of emptiness can so easily be hijacked by our Western materialistic nihilism. Emptiness means that the nature of things, the nature of ourselves and of others, is actually unbounded. Like space, says Shantideva, it's endless, vast, deep. It's gambhira. Gambhira is actually a synonym for emptiness. Sometimes the Shunyavada, the emptiness school, is called the Gambhirayana, the Gambhiravada, the way of the profound, the way of emptiness. Remember, Arya Avalokiteshvaro Bodhisattva Gambhiram Charyam Charamano. The Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, caused deeply in the deep course of the wisdom that has gone beyond. It's that that intuits emptiness, which is itself the vast deep. The vast, the limitless depths of the skandhas, he sees rupang shunyata, shuva shunyataiva rupang. Form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness no other than form. I think it's best to think of that emptiness or of the skandhas as being vast and deep. In other words, the analysis of our personalities, which is what the skandhas are, the analysis of all beings, the vision of all beings, is that we are, in fact, vast and deep. That's our nature. It's a wonderful passage in the Ratnaguna Sanchayagata, Prajna Paramita, the verses of the perfection of wisdom, which are the accumulation of precious qualities, a section that Dr. Konza translates as deep stations. Deep are form, feeling and will, consciousness and perception, signless in their essential original nature, and calm. Like one who tries to reach the bottom of the ocean with a stalk, so when the skandhas have been considered with wisdom, one does not get to the bottom of them. When a bodhisattva thus understands that these dharmas in the deep vehicle are in the ultimate sense stainless, wherein there is neither skandha, nor sense field, nor element, how can there be to him the attainment of his own merit anywhere? There are also perfection of wisdom passages where Subhuti is having a dialogue with the Buddha, by where he's talking about the deep of the perfection of wisdom, the deep of the true nature of all dharmas. And their dialogue leads to a point where Subhuti just bows in homage and reverence to the depth of the perfection of wisdom, the profound depths of emptiness. It's very, very important that we realize this. Emptiness is in no way nihilistic. It just wants to say there are no boundaries. No boundaries, no bottom, no heights to the endlessness of us, of all beings. And we suffer so much because we don't open to that vastness, that vast potential, you might say. And notice in that verse from the perfection of wisdom that the bodhisattva doesn't see any attainment of his own merit. Shantideva talks in those verses I read earlier about his merit because of his realization of emptiness just flooding out for beings. When you realize emptiness, there's no notion of anything for yourself. Whatever you might, whatever virtues you might have, qualities you might have, they are for others because you've completely seen through self and other. So emptiness leads to the making of merit and goodness for everyone. And this is, of course, the topic of Shantideva's final chapter, chapter 10, Parinamana, which means transforming, turning over everything for the benefit of all. This represents the fulfillment, the consummation of the bodhisattva's work. These verses represent how Shantideva wants to live. You could say it's describing, it's a few verses describing the creativity, the endless creativity that pours out of emptiness, out of the realization of emptiness, that pours out of bodhicitta. This last chapter is very important, especially in Tibetan Buddhism. It's often used at the end of rituals. It's often used, apparently, in funeral ceremonies. Many years ago in Bodh Gaya, I participated in a puja led by the Dalai Lama, which ended with a recitation of chapter 10 and then lots and lots of mantra chanting. There is no time to explore all or much of this last chapter. I just want to read a few verses to give you a flavour of Shantideva. by the good act that is mine, from considering this Bodhicharyavatara, may all beings adorn the Bodhisattva's path. And may all those in any of the directions, tortured in body or spirit, gain by my merits oceans of happiness and joy. As long as they remain in samsara, may they never lose their gladness. Let the world receive uninterrupted happiness from the Bodhisattvas. Let the embodied beings in however many hellish states are found in the world spheres enjoy the happiness and delight of Sakavati. That those afflicted by cold find warmth. That those afflicted by heat be cooled by oceans of water pouring from the great cloud of Bodhisattvas. Not long after that, Shantideva evokes the vision of different Bodhisattvas, Vajrapani, Avalokiteshvara, Kshitigarbha, Manjugosha and Samantabhadra entering the deepest hells. And when we read these passages, we need to vividly visualize this and aspire to become that kind of Bodhisattva. May the servants of Yama and the gruesome crows and vultures watch in fear as without warning. Here the darkness disperses on all sides. Whose is this gentle radiance, bringing forth happiness and pleasure? Wondering this, gazing upwards, may they see in the sky the blazing Vajrapani, and their vileness vanished from the force of his delightfulness, may they go to him. A shower of red lotuses falls, mingled with fragrant waters. It is seen to quell the unquenched fires of hell. What is this, they think, suddenly refreshed with joy? May those in hell see the one who holds a red lotus in his hand. Come, come quickly, put away fear, brothers. We are alive. See, some prince in the robes of a monk has come to us, resplendent, bringing fearlessness. By his power, all affliction is removed. Streams of bliss gush forth. The perfect bodhicitta is born. So too compassion, the mother of protection for all beings. Look at that one. His lotus feet are honoured by the crowns of hundreds of deities. His gaze is moist with compassion. On his head rains down a stream of many flowers, let fall from the upper stories, delightful with the singing of 1,000 divine damsels, eloquent with praise. On seeing Manjugosha before them, may those in hell immediately send up a roar of delight. In this way, through my skillful deeds, may those in hell rejoice at beholding these clouds bearing cool, sweet-scented breezes and showers of well-being on which bodhisattvas are revealed with Samantabhadra at their head. May the intense pains and fears of those in hell be allayed. May those dwelling in all evil realms be freed from those states of woe. It does seem so extreme. I can imagine friends of mine saying, well, it's all a bit over the top, Padmavajra. But in case you're worried about that, Shantideva mentions very practical things, things we must do for one another, ordinary things for one another, very topical things for one another at this time. May the fearful become fearless, and those oppressed by grief find joy. May those who are anxious be rid of their anxiety and feel secure. May health come to the sick. May they be freed from every fetter. May those with weak minds find strength, their minds tender towards each other. May every region be hospitable to those who travel the roads. With whatever aim may they set out, may their plan succeed. May those embarked on sea voyages succeed in their heart's desire. May they come safely to shore and rejoice with their families. May the gods send timely rain and may crops flourish. May the populace prosper, and may the king and the rulers be righteous. May medicines be potent. May no being ever suffer, nor be wicked, nor diseased, be neither despised nor forsaken. May no one be dejected. He also makes aspirations for the well-being of the spiritual communities, for monasteries and nunneries, for meditators and scholars. He knows that such places are crucial for the well-being of the world. He wants Buddhist institutions like our centres and retreat centres to be strong. The world needs them. May the monasteries be well appointed, humming with the recitation of the sutras. May the Sangha always be in harmony, and may the purpose of the Sangha be fulfilled. May monks experience solitude and take pleasure in their precepts, their minds supple, devoid of all distraction. May they experience meditative absorption. May nuns receive support. May they be friendly and free from harassment. And may the ethical conduct of all those who enter the spiritual community remain unbroken. And finally, Shantideva concludes with verses expressing his intense devotion to Manjushri, who he also calls Manjugosha, and also Manjunata. He wants to be embraced by him, blessed by him, protected by him. Remember, it's Manjushri who is Shantideva's direct teacher, from whom really the Bodhicharya Avatara comes. He asks Manjugosha to inspire him to devote himself endlessly to the Bodhisattva's endless work. He honours him, Manjugosha, and he honours his nameless Kalyanamitra, his spiritual friend. And we're going to end with these verses. And after these verses, we're going to chant the mantra of Manjushri, of Manjugosha. And we're doing this in honour of Manjugosha, in honour of Shantideva, in honour of Urgyan Sangharakshita, in honour of all the great bodhisattvas. Through being embraced by Manjugosha, may I always gain entry into the spiritual community and recollect my former births until I reach the stage of delight. May I remain full of strength, whatever the posture I adopt. In all my lives, may I acquire the means for the solitary life. When I desire to see or ask anything, may I see without obstruction the protector Manjunata himself. May my own conduct emulate that of Manjushri, who works to achieve the welfare of all living beings throughout the 10 directions of space. As long as space abides, and as long as the world abides, that long may I abide, destroying the sufferings of the world. Whatever suffering is in store for the world, may it all ripen in me. May the world find happiness through all the pure deeds of the bodhisattvas. The sole medicine for the ailments of the world, the mine of all success and happiness. May the teaching of the Buddha, with all honour and glory, endure till the end of time. I bow down to Manjugosha, through whose inspiration my mind turns to the good. I honour the spiritual friend, through whose inspiration the good grows strong. Om Adapajana Di, 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 Om Madhapajanadhi, Om Madhapajanadhi.